Hidden Growth Champions, the podcast. Business news, views, and insights from across the globe.
Welcome to Hidden Growth Champions, our podcast series. Now in its fourth season, we look at change makers. We look at CEOs of organizations that are changing the paradigms in their industries. We look at the various partnerships and different ways in which they collaborate with others. And we look into the insights of what's coming ahead. So Dipneel, very, very glad to have you on our podcast series. I know you're traveling as we speak. Great to have you on our show and welcome. Please tell us a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, pleasure to be on the show, Saad. It's really a privilege to be on your show.
Could you tell us a little bit about yourself, about your history? How did you come to the role that you're playing at the moment?
So mine is in quite an contrarian journey. I'm trained as a certified public accountant, but I never went into that route and certified public accounts. I actually started my career in banking and in corporate banking, in investment banking. Mm-hmm. Then I leapfrogged into having my own entrepreneurial journey, where I set up what we would call today a B2B fintech business from ground zero. And in 10 years' time, it was a very successful entrepreneurial venture that got sold. And then from there, I started into my funding journey into technology. Mm-hmm. Initially through an accelerator, and now in the current avatar with a full-fledged fund. We try to actually question all the narratives of our VC world and try to set it on its head. We don't believe in the 100-mile radius investing thesis. Rather, we believe in technology has built, make our world flat. And hence, it's all about finding outstanding businesses wherever they are, the rare gems. And so we are in the journey of joining dots. And yes, that's how we say in our tagline to our logo that the world is our oyster. And towards that, we have landed up with most of our investments today with US and then with Israel. And as you mentioned in the introduction, I'm actually headed towards to Israel this time, my annual visits there. And this, I'm going back after COVID. So I'm very highly excited to be there.
That's fantastic. We're definitely going to dive into your approach to venture capital and what you found on the way. But just take me a little bit back. If you had to explain to people who are not in the midst of the VC industry, how it has changed, how it's become its own asset class, why is there so much interest these days in VCs, even in the midst of corporates and some very interesting collaborations that are taking place? Just help us to understand how the industry has evolved and the kind of shape that it's taking.
Right. I think in one word, if I may sum that up, the interest is disruptive innovation. The amount of disruptive innovation that is happening all around us, and this is all engineered by technology, is mind-blowing. And with passage of every year, this the cycles have got compressed, by which I mean that amount of disruption it can cause and over a time period it can cause has become significantly lesser and lesser. Just imagine in 120-year period since the dot-com bubble burst, today we have 4-5 comes. So the entire most valuable companies of our world today are all technologies. Berkshire Hathaway is the only exception, but Berkshire Hathaway also has 42% of its investment in Apple alone. So that way it's a proxy to Apple, I would say. Yes. Everyone else is technology. If I go back to the beginning of the this century and cut the same pie, you will see Japanese banks, pharmaceutical companies, you will see oil majors. They are all in that list, Americans. In fact, there were five in 1998. None of those five are there in that list today. But Americans have today almost 13 companies in that list. There were about 7 or 8 Japanese there. There's none today. So that has been the transition. And you may talk about saying that the valuations are all wrong, they are fraught. But these companies that we are talking about, if you take the first 4, 5, 6 of them, they have more cash in their balance sheet than any sovereign in our world in terms of their foreign currency reserves, except Japan and China. So that's the amount of disruption. And in this 20-year period, Apple, BlackBerry, Nokia have become history. And there are many as we speak in the new industry, look at automobile, many will become history by the turn of this decade. So being that kind of a disruption, and most of this disruption, because today we have flush with liquidity, are getting played out in the private marketplace. No one wants to get listed. You know, Elon Musk's famous quotes where he says that Tesla has given most of the pain in his life and he will list SpaceX as late as possible. So with that happening, if you really want to have a play in these kind of outstanding businesses, before they become fully valued or overvalued, you have to go to the private market. And the only way for you to go is the VC route.
Yes.
Because we are minority investors. We are different from PE. We stop where the PE start. So PEs try to basically take a controlling stake, sit around the table, try to tell you how to run your business. They have a 3-5 year in time horizon to unlock the value and then take you to flip you. VCs have a far longer period. They come very early. Over the years, they take haircuts and they stay on the journey. They play on the multiplier, and that's where their ROIs come. So it's a way. That's where you know all the draw. And if disruption never happens from inside, and that's where that so much of an interest in corporate world to be part of this VC playground. Because if you do not know what is happening here, a Bay Area young kid can actually disrupt you. And again, this has happened. Look at Airbnb, just to give you one example.
Now, this is really fascinating, because if I go back to the beginning of VC, they spoke very much, or they described themselves as risk capital. And I imagine coming out of the accounting world, that was almost the antithesis of what you were taught, right? So when we start to see others participating in this, from corporates to research institutions to governments, to sovereigns, as well as a whole plethora of VC firms. Has that definition changed? Are we still talking about this is the exception to how we go about investing? This is the kind of risk capital that others are unwilling to take? Or is the perception of VC changed fundamentally?
I think if this narrative changes, then VC doesn't remain VC anymore. But I will address that in a different way. Buffett says, risk is when you don't know what you are doing. So when you know what you are doing, there is no risk. To give you a very layman example, maybe when the red man in the pedestrian signal is flashing, that's one of the best times to cross the road if there are no traffic, because you are keeping a lookout. But while the green man is flashing and you are on your phone and you are crossing the road, there could be a car who is trying to stop at the stop line and his brakes fail and he comes and hits you. You have not kept a lookout because the red green man is flashing. So that's where the risk perceptions, actually what is the accounting world has told us, the legal world has taught us, are quite different from actual risk perceptions. That said, if we are looking for a 10 out of 10 success story, then we are not VCs. The VC narrative of 2 out of 10 still remains. All that has changed probably is that by knowing what you are doing, by learning faster than others could, and not relying on analogy or your knowledge or your experience, but thinking this way, that or imagining that everything is possible under the blue sky, you try to move that 2 out of 10 success story to 3 out of 10 or 4 out of 10. And that generates superior alpha for you and for all your stakeholders, so much so that no other asset classes can even come close. Even at 2 out of 10 asset class, no other asset classes come close. 2 out of 10 gives you about 20% IRR. A 3 or a 4 out of 10 will therefore give you north of 30-35% IRR, and money doubles in 15%.
Yes.
So that's where, you know, the narrative hasn't changed. The narrative has got even fine-tuned and become more efficient. But it's all about us to go into the unknown. If you call that risk, then it is really risk. But then by the time it is known, it is crowded space, which means it is fully valued or overvalued.
So with that in mind, maybe just kind of walk us through the kind of things that you see your firm distinguish itself from the kind of the very often the kind of investment thesis that we hear from many VCs, whether, for example, they focus on early versus middle or late stage investing, or where, to your point, they focus on the 100 kilometer radius. Talk us a little bit through how you saw things differently. And therefore, when you talk about risk capital, it's no longer the traditional definition of high risk, but it's, as you said, when you know what you're doing and you have a different view of the world and you have a different thesis to it, you can manage risk better. So perhaps walk us through this a bit.
Right. So I think the first thing and first and foremost is that we invest in people. and not in business plans, not in discounted future projected cash flows, whatever that accounting world taught us in terms of valuation, because those are all lines in the sand.
Right.
We have to first believe that ideas can also change. It actually comes from a very old proverb or a quote where it is said that machines never fight. It is the men behind the machines. Similarly, ideas never germinate into innovations. It is the people behind those ideas who make them happen. That takes our world on its head. That makes so much of a change to our world, to our life, to our livelihood, that we are unable to live without those innovations, like the smartphone. It's a computer in your pocket.
Yes.
Like the EVs coming out of people who had no experience of car making or battery making. And they not only change the automobile industry for good, they are make our planet greener. And nobody talking about ESG and climate has ever been able to think or do anything similar to those. So the whole narrative is about people. And that's what we look for. And these people could be anywhere. So therefore, you don't need to be concentrated on that 100-mile radius. Yes, one day it was a fantastic model. Even today, if you are just focusing on that 100-mile radius, you have to be really picking your bets very, very carefully, because everyone knows that that's the best place to be. But then that 100-mile radius narrative mostly came out from the fact that the people with the money need to guide with the people with the ideas to make the ideas germinate into innovation.
Yes.
But which is no more today the case. Today, the world has become so much flat. And today, the technology has made the world so much flat that people with ideas, they are the best judges of how to convert them into innovation or disruptive innovation. And therefore, people with money, they just need to get a play in them, need to fuel their dreams so that they can become a reality. So therefore, angel investing or in order to say mentoring actually doesn't work so well. And that's what we firmly believe in Decacon, in our fund. And that's where, you know, we don't try to see that as a starter. We don't want to sit around the table and tell the founders how to run their business just because one day I was a successful entrepreneur who had a successful outcome. Because if I can do that, then I should do another entrepreneurial journey, set up another startup. I can make much more for myself doing that rather than betting on others. So that's, to us, is the backseat driving. How we try to help it doesn't mean that we don't help our entrepreneurs. They are let alone. It's more on the reverse inquiry, because once they have to first go out and try for themselves and figure out that they were wrong. Once they are wrong, the day they realize that they had made mistake, that's their journey to correcting those mistakes begin. And that's where they come back and ask for help. There are always asks that our founders are asking for. And our aim is to how to get them those asks, how to connect them through our network into fulfilling those asks that they are in need of, rather than we telling them which direction to drive or which way the wind is blowing and to fly the kite. So that's where, you know, it has completely changed in our opinion, and we try to therefore follow that. And hence, as I said, technology made the world flat. You have to join dots. Today, there are several destinations that have come up beside the Bay Area where some incredible work is happening. And you need to find those incredible journeys and be part of them, their story.
One of the things that we've seen is, to your point, we see these ecosystems coming out in very interesting places. You know, we see farmers in Canada, for example, coming together and starting to develop a very interesting ecosystem to battle climate change. We see ecosystems in the north of Israel, for example, very, very similar around food production. We see it in Asia. We see it even in African markets. Today can connect and make the world flat using particularly mobile technology. So kind of with that in mind, are you more optimistic about our ability to find new ideas? Are you more optimistic about our ability of entrepreneurs to turn these ideas into innovation versus, for example, where you were a decade ago?
Absolutely. And for that, I have a very strong reason. The reason being the prowess of technology. A lot of things today, what the entrepreneurs can even dream of, and then convert them into ideas and then implement them sooner than later, would not have been possible a decade ago or two decades ago. I give you another one very simple instance. Look at the whole ride-hailing industry, which is today matured. It's a very mature stock. But then just go back, this ride-hailing industry would not have been possible at the turn of this century when GPS was at its infancy. And GPS is a military discovery. It's only when that Korean passenger liner got shot down by the Russian jets accidentally when it strayed over into Siberia is that when Ronald Reagan was then the prime minister and president, and he then allowed GPS use to be given out by Pentagon for civilian purposes. And from there, that proliferation happened. And that's where the whole Google Maps, Apple Maps, everything came up. It would not have been possible earlier. Same is with genomics. Like today, we are able to sequence a gene for less than $1,000 and even $500. Earlier days, it would have taken $25,000, $30,000. You would have known anybody if in your extended near family, friends had genetic diseases. So this is the prowess of the technology. As a result, a huge new chain of opportunities opening up. When you look at the CRISPR-Cas9 discoveries for which one American and one French lady got their Nobel Prize in 2019, this is a wonderful editing tool, gene editing tool. But for editing the gene, you first need to sequence the gene. And that's where technological prowess has brought in. I mean, look at the amount of gaming revolution that has taken a lot of stuff that... So gaming is actually a forerunner of our imagination. So what of a lot of stuff these gamers or game composers imagine, dream, actually can therefore in the longer term can become realities of our lives. So military, gaming, these kind of applications, they have really given, fired our imagination, and technology has enabled us to convert those imaginations into reality. So certainly with passage of every year, almost we are getting better.
It's interesting when you were talking, I was kind of thinking of the likes of Peter Diamandis, for example, who's kind of coined the or striving towards a target of getting genetic testing down to $1 a test, which I guess opens up enormous opportunities. So the kind of quantum shift that we're seeing both in the access to as well as the cost of. But that brings me to a different point, which is around who do we collaborate with? Who do we work with? Who do we partner with to create those networks that, to your point, help entrepreneurs test their ideas, and in some cases are necessary to commercialize some of these ideas into real innovations, market innovations. So tell us a little bit about when you think about who else gets involved when it goes beyond the VC and the entrepreneur whom they are invested in. What kind of role players in this ecosystem come to mind for you? Who are the ones that you see add value on this journey?
Right. I think that's a great question. What we again go back to our, I can't speak about my industry, but I can definitely speak about what we try to do. And we think that it is working for us, although we are calibrating our approach or guide path every day, every time. So there's nothing called standard operating procedure in our industry, nothing called manual in our industry. We learn every day. We go to bed learning something new so that we can wake up next day wiser. From that standpoint, again, we go back to that fundamental thing of people. What we basically, how do we calibrate the people whom we want to back or where we want to be part of their story, their journey, is basically what's the draw? Why are you doing what you are doing? And if you are trying to do this, do you have any hard skills that will help you or that will enable you to solve this big problem, which has got a huge adoption curve, instant gratification? And that's where, you know, most of the crux of the story or the judgment lies. The people there are out there for a reason. And if you can get that reason, and that reason may not be a direct product of the problem that they are trying to solve. We are not looking for PhDs in genetic sciences. We are rather looking, remember, most of the disruption happened from people who had no clue about the industries that they disrupted, whether it is Airbnb or whether it is Steve Jobs, whether it's Elon Musk, whether it is Jeff Bezos, you name it, Sergey Brin, Larry Page. So all the big disruptions that have happened, they have happened from people who had no idea or no experience of the industry that they were trying to disrupt. They knew only one thing, that there is a problem. And they always believed that they can... have a solution to that problem. And they went on to find what works as against what does not work. And those were like out of nowhere. And that's how the disruption has happened. And that's how disruption never happens from inside. A Hyatt or a Hilton cannot disrupt itself the way Airbnb can. So a Nokia, BlackBerry, Ericsson cannot disrupt the way Apple did. So there are all huge case studies even around them. And that narrative still remains. And that is what we need to find out. Basically, the people behind the idea. Once you have the right people, then the ecosystem falls in place on its own. It forges together.
So one role player in the ecosystem that does get a lot of attention are corporates who are, in their word, trying to disrupt themselves. Very often, it not great success rates. So when I look at the arguments that they're putting together, particularly in industries in which there is no open access, Airbnb, I guess, in a way, was fortunate that the access was in the hands of consumers. But when I think, for example, about the energy transition, where access to the grid matters, when I think about industries like healthcare, where there's still major institutions involved, the way in which corporates have participated in this ecosystem often came out from their size, the size of their balance sheet, the capital they could deploy into it, but very, very few successes. What do you see? I mean, to a point where today the investment by corporates in VC type activities probably rivals that in terms of size, that of VCs themselves. So when I think about that, what would you see as the role of corporate, seeing that they are very much struggling to disrupt themselves? What productive role can they take in this ecosystem?
Yeah, actually, there are two types of corporate role I see. One corporate role is a very traditional M&A type of a role, or a modified M&A type of a role. Hmm. I have money in my balance sheet, and then I will spend that money to acquire someone who I think is giving me a lot of trouble and eating my market share, or I would acquire him because I think he's doing something where I am weak at and my competition is as strong at. But those are all faulty analogies. There's another type of corporates, and actually these are some of the big techs. They are very smart ones. They are also very, very worried about disruption, but they are not using the cash. And they also know that disruption will never happen from inside. They will happen from, despite they being techs. So therefore, they use the cash in their balance sheet to seed the market, just like VCs. Instead of us, we taking money from several LPs, they are their only LP. And in that, I can throw you some examples to make my analogy fit in. Like, you may think Google is a search engine. Google is a online advertiser. That's where they make money. No, to me, Google is a corporate VC. Mm. The way they go out and invest in companies like DeepMind, from where then comes protein folding, and then they name it as AlphaFold, the product, but they keep DeepMind aside. They don't integrate DeepMind with them. They don't go to DeepMind to kill DeepMind or think that, you know, someday Microsoft will do something or Amazon will do something in that space. And before they gulp him out, we go and gulp him up. They are going because they like what DeepMind is doing. So they are just like VCs. They are groping in the dark. They will make many investments, most of which will not work out. Similarly, in China, there is one more company. We may think, oh, their main play is WeChat. Everything that you want to do is on one platform, mega scale, single platform. It's Tencent. But that's drastically successful corporate VC who has almost fingers in every pie in whatever is happening in that market. So if the corporates play a different game, they will realize that the big problem, but if they play the Intel game, if they play the HP game, they play the IBM game, then they're doomed. They will. And in fact, that's actually very good for our world. These corporates, so nobody is here forever, right? Every human being reach a poor. We are born to die. So why will IBM and Intel's will stay there forever? Why should be something they leave for generations and generations and generations? And the fact that technology is able to push them over the cliff, will make them go down the chute bin into the cliff and fall into a deep gorge and crash and die, is a very great thing for our world. We are removing inefficiencies. In my mind, the new order should be that if the Pfizer's of the world cannot do enough for our medical science, then Roche and Pfizer should die. That's the belief that we have. New Roches should come up. New Pfizer should come up. Why should we relate to Mercedes and BMWs and Toyotas? It's time for them to die.
Mm. So with that in mind, are you seeing corporates that, you know, beyond the technology sector, are taking that view? Are you seeing corporates that, for example, when I think about healthcare, when I think about industries that are in major transition, telecommunications firms, another one, are you seeing firms in those industries taking on that role? Or is it still very much a technology play that's taking place?
Yeah, so the way I see it, most of them, they are not taking on the role. But to be honest and to be fair to them, I have a different analogy there. And that analogy is that they have no choice. They cannot take on the role. If they try to take on that role, their existence will actually get further compressed. And so it's more a fiefdom play. Because today, these are being run by managers who never created anything. They got these companies in inheritance. And for them, they are there for a tenure. And they're just trying to protect their fiefdom so that their tenure passes away and they can go away with their options and with their pensions and with their gratuities.
Yes.
So it's a very different ballgame as compared to startup founders who know that if they cannot disrupt or be part of a disruptive journey, their journey is over.
Maybe a last question from my side, and that's around the startup owners. What advice would you give to those who seem to think they have an idea, who are ready perhaps to test it with people like yourselves? What advice would you give them?
I would rather give them two advices. They must be having a real solid, passionate reason to be doing what they are doing. And that cannot be just a cool thing to do, or I want to retire rich, or I want to be my own boss. These are not the reasons. The second thing is that if you really want to solve a hard problem that has a large addressable market, you have to find out, do you have any skills that enables you to solve that hard problem? And if you don't, can you find out people who has those skills? Can you assemble a team around you who is even better than you? That could be also an outstanding skill to have. And in that, if I may give you one example, is that even people like Steve Jobs had these skills, if you see. Tim Cook, in his own, words, says in one of the interviews, most probably with David Rubenstein, where he says that he went to take that interview with Steve Jobs because somebody told him to take that interview who he could not say no. And he was very clear in his mind that he doesn't want to work for this man, given the bad press that he has heard about him. And he goes to that, but in that 1 hour, somehow Steve Jobs mesmerizes him and hypnotizes him in a way, so to say. He comes out of that meeting and then finally goes in and works for him. And if you really see, Apple has done far better after Mr. Jobs has passed away in the reins of Tim Cook. Rather than previous history when Jobs was on the saddle. So it was Jobs' ability to find his successor that made Apple what Apple it is today. In our world, we will see many examples where statesmen, industrial powerhouses, family-run businesses, they have come up the curve like unbelievably well, but they could not find a right successor. And that's where empires went down, dynasties went down, corporate worlds went down, GE, a classic example, and even countries went down from their glorious pasts to doldrums. And that's where the quality of the leadership is. And if these founders, they have this ability to find people better than them to work for them, they are the founders who will always get back and money will never run out for them.
Maybe as a last point, as we kind of end off this podcast episode, as you were speaking, it reminded me of a conversation we have on a monthly basis with what we call challenger CEOs, people who are leading organizations that are pushing against the envelope or pushing the envelope forward rather. And the conversation was about how do you take innovations out of the lab into commercial scale? But through that conversation, it very quickly, everyone realized in the room, and then someone then stated it, that actually those innovations are found in the street. And the conversation was about how do we go out to the street? How do we find those individuals, those good ideas that we won't find in our labs, that we won't find in our R&D shops, that we won't find in our current partnerships, but we'll have to go out to the street and find. And I think, Joshua, if I could just, I guess, bring you here as a last point into the discussion. I think it's very similar to the kind of work that you do, that you've shared with me and your extensive travels. And perhaps a nice way of us to kind of round off the discussion is about how do we play out there in the street to find the ideas that will change this century and the kind of way in which we will work and play in this century.
So I think that's like what Demnew said earlier, you know, the technology that we have today is no longer limited to a few people in a lab, right? Nowadays, we all have computers, we all have phones, and we all have the ability to access the internet. So even the whole idea of schools, right, the going to an institution or a building or a classroom, that might be fundamentally different from 50 years ago. But still, a lot of these educational institutions, they download information on the students. They make you sit around the lecture theater and then tell you, this is how certain things are done, this is how certain things are not done. And then if you see most of these professors or academics or people with a lot of accolades, they might not have even done anything credible in their own life. So that's why they are teaching, right? That's why they have not found a job and they are going to work and tell people how to run businesses, how to start companies, but then they have not really done anything in that space. So even a taxi driver who's somewhat an entrepreneur himself might be able to teach you more about, you know, how I can optimize my route, how I can spend my time in the day well so that I can increase my revenues. And these are again ways that people on the street may, you know, have much more value than people in the lab or in the classroom or in the workshop for that matter. And I think when it comes to innovation, right, there's no rule book for that, right? Like you have to really throw out all the rule books, because innovation in itself, like just going for a course in innovation is really quite oxymoronic. Like how are you going to teach someone to not follow the rules? Like that doesn't make sense at all to me.
Well, with that point, thank you, Joshua. Guys, thanks for a riveting conversation. I know we could probably stay on the line for another hour to talk about this. We'll make sure the podcast episode is ready and available to our listeners. It will be launching in a few weeks' time. Thanks again for the conversation and the perspective that you shared. Wish you all the best on your travels, Daniil, and I'm sure that we'll find the time to meet again.
Sure. Wonderful. Thanks a lot, Sar, for giving us this opportunity. And it's so incredibly fascinating. And I guess through people like you, we need to educate the world at large. And more people will get incited and ignited into this journey. And therefore, we will have more and more outstanding people becoming our tribesmen, joining our community. I think we all have a role to play here. And it's great really to be on this show and for the work that you're doing. If there's any way we could be of any help, always we are here, and just give us a shout.
Thank you both. Have a great day further.
Thank you. Bye.
Hidden Growth Champions, the podcast. Join us next time for more business news, views, and insights from across the globe.